I'm going to read poems from a book I've been working on the last few years called Hearing Harry Say. The Harry of this title is Harry Truman. It refers to my first memory, which was seeing Harry Truman while on top of my father's shoulders while a whistle stop campaigned through Ohio. And that title poem is a reminiscence of that event, and most of these poems are reminiscences that work chronologically through the 50s and 60s up to a more recent past. The first poem is called Polio Summer. It wasn't the disease that worried. It was the apparatus, iron lung, quarantine. The first I became aware of it were blinds pulled on Old Main Cross and a hanging silence even in the cars that drove slowly home from work. And even though the blinds were pulled, I felt watched. That was quarantine. I imagined a girl like myself in bed in a high dark room losing touch with her friends and the feeling in her legs. And I remember the dark, flickering quality of the Sister Kenny ads and the small children quavering in metal braces, diminished by the metal. I hurried through my piano lesson. Mother walked me home to protect me from those who weren't allowed to play outside, either. On that empty street in Findlay on a yellow August day, I felt the iron lung in my heart pulling for cold air. And soon after, the blinds went up, and there was a teacher who walked around her shortened leg like a pivot, and a series of visits from the soldierly school health nurse who administered the pink shots. But some stayed in the iron lung and wrote their answers with their teeth. Some of you may be too young to remember X-ray machines in shoe stores. Now we find out that some of us have feet that are like little time bombs because we like to shove them under the X-ray and see if our shoes fit. But in any case, this poem is called Scene in the Blue Fluttering Like an Old Movie. It was the age of Krypton, and anyone could have their feet X-rayed. Even Geminers had a Nickelodeon-sized X-ray machine. And there were my bones, narrow, wing-like things. There was a place for me to look and the woman to look, and then I got shoes, open-toed Mary Janes that turned my winged foot fluttering bones into leathery webs. The sun cooked the curb where I waited for the light, then I crashed across the street slapping my new shoes. My toes developed picture perfect, only they tingle and tick like a clock. Gum for breakfast. Basketballs thump the playground. I am not close enough, but I can hear the screech of pro kids grab cement, and my hands get a little dirty. Girls at recess race like banners at the edge of a field. A bell rings, and brick red balls roll downhill. My hands are a little calloused from Skin the Cat. There is never time to drink enough. A wad of chewels indented with teeth grins in the water fountain. I'm still breathing heavy. Fish hands. The mechanic's son can fix a Betsy in his sleep. Raw bones drag his coveralls after him like shed skin. Pa tells how he cut his teeth on a retread. There is no way he can get his buttons closed over those wrench wrists. Humpback, sight fixed on a purring V8, he has a vestigial memory of the first Dynaflow blasting down the drag like a boat. Rush hour, music of the spheres, he washes down his lunch with a hose, inseparable from the glaucous light of the bay, cocked and poised for another sound, an engine skipping. His heart flies out to the Bonneville, breaking water at the light. The Incredible Journey. The two kids next door go by wearing clothes you can almost see being outgrown. The girl carries a basketball like an orb. The boy, his books in a food town bag. They walk like they are royalty or dreaming, and then the fog swallows them. But you can still hear the school bells chime like buoys in the mist. And you know they arrived safely when, after the last bell, they reappear, carrying their books like trays and a carefully worn emptiness in their eyes. In New York City, there was an art theater kind of on the level of the Tivoli, only inside it was incredibly scuzzy, and the place is gone by the wayside. But that's the scene that I imagine for the setting of this poem, which is called Cinema Verite. This is an art theater, and it's a little like my old high school gym. The same wooden seats, the same sharp scent of mold. If someone had made a film of my high school, say, when JFK was killed, they could show it here on this sloping screen that resembles a trampoline turned on its side. And it would be an amazing sight, for there would be such fear on the faces of so many watching TV. Just before it happened, we were watching Carol Worley in the last row of sixth period open a Nestle's Crunch with the stiletto of her fingernail. I will never forget how quietly she could do it. One of those intercoms hummed by the door, and just before the flag tore through the air, there was the murmur of static, as if someone had placed a hand over the microphone and was listening. We never imagined how hard it would be to sleep, or how some of us home on Sunday morning, because we couldn't stop watching TV, saw Jack Ruby stick a gun into Lee Harvey Oswald's belly, and the way Oswald caved in, pushing his mouth out in a silent O. This would be a part of what was shown. Eventually, we went numb, and the Beatles or Barbara Streisand took Kennedy's place. There were the nightly body counts, LBJ and his scar. Everything we learned we got from the screen, condensed, mutilated, or redundant. Like this film about the decadence and banality of everyday life. It ends with an apocalypse where a major U.S. city burns to the ground. And the last thing you see are the hordes, faces melting, running into the light. When Kennedy was president, they were still telling us that hiding under our desks would do some good. Natural borders. In the middle of a bridge between two unfriendly nations, our spy and their two spies, who rank below ours, change places. From here, it looks like a dream. Through the graininess of space, the dozen older men glitter a little in the half-light. All this is as muted and black and white as film. Our spy wears their clothes, a square-cut dark suit and a tie that even from here looks to be 20 years out of fashion. We can see the weary copy tick from the machine, the first thing he asked for, hamburger, Coke, fries. But everything is subdued for now, a grim and important handshake, and at a signal, the exchange of spies. It isn't cloak and dagger. It is bureaucratic, orderly, and some of their people carry our spies' souvenirs, a rug, a box of fur hats, as if these meetings take place more often, as if there are no barricades at either end, and in the forest, no nervous guards peering down high-powered scopes. There is mutual belief in the capacity to kill this spy, that envoy, the men in the woods, an entire race. This is how it looks from above, a plane racing a radar even now, too high to be seen, squeezing off shots that show a missile, a row of trailers, or a cluster of men gathered at dawn in the middle of a bridge. It's worked out in air, a kind of boring joke, their side, our side, this tree, that listening post. What the picture will show is a bridge at the center of a target, rising on both sides, mountains blanketed with pines, and then bare rock, and then snow. The missing child. The missing child is not missing within himself. He is at war in a place where nothing is familiar. For one day he wanders a field of corn, an ocean of parked cars, or sleeps in a place where dogs fought. The voices of those who are searching ring out in his dreams. They frighten him deeper into himself. In town, his face stares out from every shop, his hair much lighter than it is now. A solitary child is brought in, approved, and the search is called off. As this happens, the one who is still lost crawls away from the voice of a stranger walking close by, who calls out his name loudly. A shadow slides in the weeds, but the tall shoes that hesitate clearly intend to steal, not to save. Maybe some of you have written a word down and then suddenly, even though you know you spelled it right, it begins to look wrong and bizarre, as if you've never seen it before. And this poem is called The Word. I stared at October so long I was sure it couldn't be spelled with an O. I thought about words until I knew I'd gone insane. The prairie thundered with buffalo. Why not bison? How can the range be a stove and a prairie too? Until I was 21, I thought I knew how to spell, but then the sudden configuration of a word made my head spin. The Chinese draw a tree, then the sun, and finally a man standing with his head in the sun. They don't have to know how to spell, only to draw and hold the pictures of the 10 kingdoms palpable and complete in the silken darkness of the mind, the way a magician's scarf conceals an endless supply of white doves. Night thoughts. You have more patience than me. You have seen more stars fall. Some of the stars, you point out, have been dead for thousands of years. Parts of constellations could be missing or imploded. A thought so depressing, I'd rather watch the wing lights of a tiny plane sawing on the diagonal low over our land. It will cross our place, then Ginther's, then sink onto the packed turf of the county airport and roll toward the crop dusters. I'd rather not think of the stars belonging to anyone like our sun or making part of a shape like a dipper or bear. I believe in the high-strung metal and the gyro that go with the lights overhead, but I can't believe in the calm face inside lit with green reading the stars. The death of a star is too big, and a falling star isn't really a star. When I look at a contrail suspended and spreading, I don't see people serving cocktails or reading the New York Times. I see something too heavy to float. And when I see stars, I see ice. Sincere. The man with the artificial heart makes plans to go on vacation. The two sides of his heart clap together like hooves. His blood splashes in a small rubber suitcase. He is packed for a long journey. The soul hums contentedly at home in the vessel that once held his heart, displayed on television looking meaty and a little fat. He asks the reporter if she wants to feel. Her smile skips a beat, and then she grasps the ticking piece which swings jauntily at the good man's side and just goes to show how far a man can travel. You rush into a black hole. You have a book that shows the planets bright as beach balls balanced smoothly in the night. Their orbits are sketched like incandescent tracks, hoops we should be able to see whirling overhead. Some planets juggle their own moons, and the bracelets of Saturn wobble like frisbees, making, in my mind, a humming as they cut the air. But there is no air, and the picture is only paint. The resemblance between constellations and animals is only from our perspective. The picture can't show how space rushes outward, or what it rushes into. Imagining the infinite makes me feel confused and small. You wonder if tumbling into a black hole would be like riding in the dryer, spinning and clanking like a zipper against the drum. What I can't fathom is the other side, being squeezed into something endless, looking out upon the clear dawn that space rushes to fill. And for all of you who are missing the basketball game tonight and regretting it, this last poem I'm going to read is called Our Team is Red Hot. This was also my Christmas poem this year. Tomorrow, the Messiah. Tonight, basketball. The holiday tournament. Protestants versus Catholics. This is holy war. God will answer the prayers of the best team or break a shooting guard's knee. Our team is short and deliberate, theirs quick and lanky. It is the era of zip-up shorts, store-bought sneakers, socks that collapse around white ankles. The cheerleaders unveil a new chant, go hoarse, stomp their feet, and lose the soft flips they spent all day sculpting. It is manic. The pep band plays Love and Honor to old PG. Old grads wave red like a charm. The Catholics fast break. We stall. It comes down to this. They can shoot foul shots. We can't. We stand in awe when their crew cut forward steps gently to the line, breathes deep, looks to the hoop, and crosses himself. Our screams rise to greet Epiphany. Thank you.